Okay, good morning, a good fach. It's good to be back here in the valley for our bi-weekly shiur. The learning we do today is Le'ilu Nishmas Ari Shlomo ben Avram Dover, and then we thank the Greenfields for the sponsorship, Le'ilu Nishmas. So the discussion I wanted to have this morning, if we can, Le'ilu Mirtz Hashem, is one which is not contemporary in the sense that it didn't come up recently. It came up a long time ago. But it's something that's persistent. So it's contemporary in the sense that we're always dealing with this question. Certainly, Rabbanim are always getting this question, but people at home are always obviously asking this question as well. And that's the question you see here in Minchas Asher, Chelek Gimel, Siman Nun Zayin, the top of your sheet, Bameshe Sha'al. He doesn't say exactly which appliance he's talking about, but Rav Asher Weiss was asked the following question, Bekelim Electronium. That's a difficult word. Anyone know what that means? Oh, very good. Okay, electronic, very good. Shebevada yiskalkalu, they will certainly be ruined. They will certainly be destroyed. Adet filasan, if you put them into a bucket of water, a bath of water, you will certainly break them. Why in the world will you dunk an electric clean a bath of water? Because you're doing tefilas kalim. You're doing tefilas kalim. Kigon kalim imtsag digitali, like appliances which have an electric cord, which have some sort of electric feature. So digital things. Are those going to be an issue for Tefilas Kalim? They will break. So therefore, what do you do? Do you tovel them even though they break? By Tefilas Kalim, even people who say, you know, O's, they say their cholam is like a cholam. But I don't know why. By Tefilas Kalim, everyone says tovel. You ever notice that? Everyone says it with an I. What's that about? It's such a yeshivish mitzvah. You ever notice that? Everyone says it that way. I don't know what that's about. So when you tovel this kli, it's certainly going to break. So what do you do? What do you do in that instance? Are you pater from Tefilas Kalim? Do you have a way around it? What exactly do you do? So let's just start with a little bit of background. The Pesukim tell us in Parshas Matos that after we fought the war with Midian, so we were told to take the Kalim from the enemies, and we were told to prepare those Kalim for new ownership and usage. The Pasuk delineates for us two things that we need to do. One of them is you need to kasher these Kalim by fire. That's libon ba'esh. You need to kasher them by fire, assuming they were used with fire beforehand. You need to kasher them. And secondly, they need to be toveled in the water. They need to be dunked in water. So what's that about? The Gemara in Avodah Zarah, Daf Ayin Hey, learns from here the idea that if a Jew purchases a kli from a non-Jew, regardless of whether he just won a war in Midian or something, but even in regular life, if you purchase a kli, a utensil, from a non-Jew, so you need to perform tefilas kalim in order to be metaher, so to speak, in order to purify for the usage of that kli. There are details in terms of which words exactly in the Pasuk teach that chiyuv. That's a question of machlokas in the Rishonim, in the Gemara, and also Allah Torah. But the klal is that we learn from here a chiyuv, an obligation to do tefilas kalim from those psukim. Why are we tovel kalim? Anyone know? What's the reason for tefilas kalim? It's not to kasher, correct? Because the first half of the Pasuk said, you have to kasher the kli. If it was used for a pig in a fire, now you have to kasher by fire in order to remove the treif from that kli. Fine, so we know it's already kosher. So what do you need a tovel kli for? What's that about? Anyone know? It's a very strange thing. So the Gemara in Avodah Zarah brings Rav Nachman, who says, I think we said it was on Daf Ayin Hey, the Gemara says, Rav Nachman says that even if the kli is totally kosher, even if it's a brand new kli, you know this, if you buy a brand new kli in a store, even though it was never used before, you hope and you assume it was never used before, you still have to tovel it. So what's that about? Why do you have to do tefillah? So the Rishonim there, there's a Rashba and a Ritva, all of them quote from the Gemara Yerushalmi. The Gemara Yerushalmi, the fifth parak of Avodah Zarah, says an amazing thing. It says that when you do tefilas kalim on a kli that was purchased from a non-Jew, it's because you're taking it from Tumas Nachri to Kedushas Yisrael. The same way that when you have a geiros, it's unbelievable, the same way that when you have a geiros, when you have a conversion, so someone switches from being non-Jewish to Jewish, so they need to do a tefillah, they need to go into the mikvah. So too, kalim, which are switching from the property, from their possession of a non-Jew to a Jew, also have to do a tefillah. They also have to do tefillah, tefillahs kalim as we know it. I don't think they need a bris milah. That's a discussion, but I assume they don't need a bris milah. And so most kalim can't do a kabbalas al malchus shamayim. Although nowadays with the new digital appliances, maybe some of them are so smart that they can be makabel mitzvos. I don't know. But generally speaking, you can be megayer them. You can convert them. Just with the tefillah in the mikvah, you put the kli in the mikvah, the keli in the mikvah, you're good to go. That's what the Rishonim seem to assume, which is a very fascinating concept. And also that parallel between tefillas kelim and tefillah of a ger may have some pretty interesting nafkaminas lehalacha. The Ritva says that when you buy a kli from a guy, so we said before that even if it was brand new, you would still need to do tefillas kelim, correct? Well, what if it's not brand new? What if you bought it from a guy and the guy has used it for a treif in the past? The guy has cooked on his dishes hot pig or whatever the case might be, hot treif. So now we know that you need to kasher it, and we know that you need to do tefillas kelim. What order does that have to be in? Does it have to be in any particular order? Can I first dunk it in the mikvah to do tefillas kelim, and then kasher it from its treif? So I would have thought, yes, why not? They're both mitzvos. One has to do with making it Jewish. You can make it Jewish, but it's still treif, and then you can make it kosher. Why does we have to go in a specific order? So this is very, very, very fascinating. The Ritva in Masech Zodazar over there says, no, it has to be specifically in the other order. Why? Because think about it. If a person wants to be metahir themselves, they want to become tahor, they want to become pure, but they were metame themselves to a bug or something. They're holding a sheretz. They're holding that bug in their hand. So if they jump into the mikvah with that sheretz in their hand, what does it work? What does it do? Vas tutmir, as they say in French. What does that do for us? What do you mean? You jumped in the mikveh, you came out, you're still holding the same bug. So you're still tutmir, you're still the same amount of impure. However, if you first get rid of the sheretz, throw it away, now you're not attached to the tum anymore, then you jump in the mikveh, you can be metahir yourself. Says the Ritva here too, we're trying to convert these kalim, these dishes, from impure to pure. So in order to do that, you need to first get rid of the treif that's in it. Now, it's not really parallel, right? Because the treif and the impurity are two separate things. One is the fact that it belongs to a non-Jew. One is the fact that it's treif, but the Ritva uses that imagery and says you can't become a Jewish utensil until you're completely free from any iser, and that's why the Ritva seems to say you need to do so. What's the implication in the Ritva is that that's actually ma'akev, meaning if a person did it in the wrong order, it wouldn't work. The tefillas kelim wouldn't work. Rav Shechter Shlita has noted in the past that it's an interesting parallel, but he says la halacha, it is quite a stretch. Again, it's a little bit of a stretch in terms of the reasoning and the application, and also even the comparison is not a perfect comparison, as we noted a second ago. So he always says it's best to do it in that order, but b'di'evit, if you did it in a different order, that would seem to be okay. That's what the Beis Yosef, the Arki Moshe, the Shulchan Aruch, I'll talk about in Siman Kuf Chaf Aleph in Yerodeya. So that's an interesting nafka mina, an interesting practical implication. Yeah.
The Gemara in Yerushalmi, where do they get it from? That there's a concept of tumas nafka to begin with.
A chiddush, yeah, a chiddush, a novel idea. Correct, a novel idea. What kind of a hashpah does the nafka have on his kelim already that it's non-Jewish? Yeah, a chiddush. Yeah, there's another thing that comes up over here as well. You have a case. The Rav Asher Weiss actually has a tshuva about this in a previous. Maybe it's actually a later tshuva, like 10 simanim later. Rav Asher Weiss writes about this as well. What if you have a non-Jew who he himself converts? You have a non-Jew, he converts, and now he's Jewish. So yesterday he was a guy, and today he's Jewish. What happens to his kalim in between? So yesterday his kalim belonged to a guy, and today his kalim belonged to a Jew. So normally, if a Jew acquires kelim from a guy, they have to tovel those kelim. You need a tefillas kelim on those dishes. So here, the guy himself was once a guy and now is a Jew. So does he need tefillas kelim as well? Or do we say no? In this funny case, it's not considered purchasing. It's considered that he was metahir himself along with the kelim somehow. So this is very fascinating. This is very, very fascinating. My Rebbe Rav Shechter Shlita quotes from Dayan Grosnas. Dayan Grosnas was a Dayan in London, in the basin of London, Ari Leib Grosnas. So he has in his Tshuvas Leib Ari in Chilek Beis, he talks about this question. And he assumes that they also need a tefillah b'mikvah, just like the ger himself needs a tefillah b'mikvah. The ger himself went to the mikvah and converted to Judaism, but his kelim, he needs to be makari of them. He needs to bring them along on the derech now, send them to an esh seminar, get them to know a few things, and then they should go in the mikvah as well and become a Jewish kelim. Rav Asher Weiss talks about this in a tshuva, and he disagrees. He assumes it does not need tefillah, all these kelim that were belonged to the non-Jew who converted to Judaism, mostly because lo shamanu, we never heard of such a thing. No one ever spoke about this. Plenty of people have converted over history, and nobody ever spoke about it in tshuvas before Dayan Grosnas about the possibility that they would need tefillah's kelim. So he says, probably, it's not necessary. Additionally, we always have a question, even if we think we understand the tameh ha-mitzvah, even if we think we understand why you have to do a mitzvah, you have to do the mitzvah because you have to convert the kelim. It's a very nice idea, but we usually don't go by tameh ha-mitzvahs on their own. We usually don't follow the reasoning for the mitzvah for practical applications. We understand the mitzvah better. There are certain hagdaras or definitions of the mitzvah, but to take that reasoning and say it has a nafka mina la-halacha, that now a non-Jew converts, has to convert their kelim also, that's a little bit far-fetched. So Rav Asher Weiss disagrees, but that was Dayan Grosnas' assumption. Either way, if you continue in our tshuva, so Rav Asher Weiss was asked, very nice about kelim, I understand that's the halacha overall, but what about these kelim that are electronic? Is there anything you can do about that? If they're going to break, do you have to tovel them? If not, do not. So if you look in the paragraph over here, L'anias Daiti Nira, says Rav Asher Weiss, now you have in the bold, D'yesh lismoch b'shofi ala chachmas adam. You can rely on the opinion of the Chachmas Adam. The Chachmas Adam was written by the same author as the Chai Adam, Rav Avraham Danzig. He was a balabas. He was a merchant or something in Vilna, and he wrote this from the side. I think by the end of his life, they made him a Rav. But most of his life, he was a working man, and he happened to learn and wrote a lot of Svarim, and he's quoted every page in Mishnah Berurah. He's a big posek. So the Chai Adam writes in the Chachmas Adam, the kli sheyefshel tovla o shechibul karka. If you have a kli, he wasn't dealing with electricity, but if you have a kli that you're unable to tivel for whatever reason, iminakvu ad shebatal mitoras kli. If you'll make a hole in it so much so that it becomes unusable, it doesn't have really any utility anymore because you've broken it so badly, vishuv yisaknu, and then you'll fix it again, pater mitvila. You are pater, you're completely exempt from doing tvilas kelim, depanim chadashos ba'ulakan. Because panim chadashos ba'ulakan. Where do we know the term panim chadashos from? Shevarachos, very good. So how does this have to do with Shevarachos? So they say a story that Reb Chaim Soloveitchik used to like point out to people who were detractors from his method of learning, which ended up, you know, winning over the yeshiva world, but initially people took issue with it. So he liked to point out to them that they would say, you got to focus on the words, not what's behind the words. So he pointed out, if you focus on the words, you're going to be misled. He used to use a different example. It wasn't Tefilas Kalin, but he said, if you learn the sugyas in the Gemaras and Tmura elsewhere about the Efer of Isrei Hana, meaning if you have something that's Aser Behana, you have certain things which you're not allowed to eat, and then you have other things which you're not allowed to eat or get any benefit from whatsoever, correct? So let's say you have something which you're not allowed to eat, nor are you allowed to get benefit from. It's Isser Hana. It's an Usser to get any benefit from it. So, and then you burn it. And now all there's left is ashes. So the Rishonim discuss over there that the reason those ashes, the Efer of the Isser Hana, are Mutter, Behana, are permissible to benefit from is because Panim Chadashos Ba'olakan. Because a new face has come to here, literally translated. So Rav Chaim Soloveitchik said, I don't understand, by Shev Brachos, why is everyone so concerned to find a new person for Panim Chadashos? They should just burn some Yisrael now and bring it to the Shev Brachos every time. Panim Chadashos, Ba'alakan. You have Panim Chadashos. He said, obviously, you have to look past the words. You shouldn't take it, no pun intended, at face value. You should look past the words. The words are the same. Panim Chadashos, Ba'alakan. Face value. Sorry, I should slow down for you guys. Nobody had coffee yet? What's going on? Panim Chadashos, Ba'alakan. It does mean, by Shev Brachos, that new faces came to the Shev Brachos. That's true. By Efer of by ashes of Yisrei Hana, it doesn't have anything to do with Shev Brachos. It means that when you have something that's Aser Behana, you can't get benefit. If you have ashes of that thing, it's a new entity. It's a completely new entity. It doesn't have any relationship with the previous thing that you burnt. That was burnt and it's gone. Now its ashes are a completely new idea, a completely new thing. Panim Chadashos Ba'alakan, something new entirely. So here too, we're using that term that Rav Asher Weiss is using for us over here, from the Chachmas Adam, that when you have, let's say, I don't know, I'm just making up a case, but you have a toaster. So the toaster is going to have bagels in it and all that, but it comes from a Gaisha company, or comes from a Gaisha, let's just say a Gaisha seller, an individual seller. So if you buy the toaster, you're stuck. You think you have to do a Tefilas Kelim. It's metal. It's used for food. This is a little bit of a debate. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein had a different opinion about this, but it's used for food. And now you need Tefilas Kelim, but what am I going to do? It's electric. It's going to break. So you take it to a Jewish, technician. He cuts off the cord, or he breaks it in such a way that it's not usable. Then he refashions it. He fixes it up for you. Now it was made anew. Oh, it was made anew in the reshus, in the possession of a Jew. So now it's a beautiful subterfuge, a beautiful kunz, a beautiful trick to get around the issue. You've evaded the issue entirely because now you have an alternative. You've made a new kli in Jewish property, so it's no longer a Gaish kli. You get out of the whole thing. So Rav Asher Weiss says that's a very good idea. That's a very good idea. That does work. And you have a digital electronic utensil that needs that type of treatment and can't go in a bucket of water. So then you would be able to get out of Tefilas Kelim doing that trick. What do you have most commonly nowadays? Keurig machine comes up a lot, right? Keurig machine comes up a lot. I think if you dunk a Keurig, for sure the newer ones, they will for sure break. There's no solving that issue. You can't dunk that without breaking it. There's what in the Keurig already needs tefillah? So this changes every couple of years. So the last time I looked into this was probably 7 years ago.
Pin?
The pin is metal, correct? The pin is metal, so that's the discussion. Is that a problem? That's touching the grounds, literally. It goes straight into it punctures the cup and it touches the grounds and shoots the water through them. So that's one thing. The other thing is that if you look inside, there's a heating chamber. So at least on the models from a few years ago, the heating chamber was made of metal. It's not even true in all the models then, and it changes all the time, like I said. But it used to be true that there were heating chambers that were made of metal. Those heating chambers, if they're just used for heating the water, that's one thing. But they may also be used, depends on the model, to heat the water, to retain the water, and to maintain the heat of the water. So they're basically holding water for a significant amount of time. So that's another part of the kli, a part of the utensil, which is touching the water, the food that you're going to be using for the coffee. And that's problematic for two reasons. One, it's metal and might need tefillas kelim. And two, you can't actually get, meaning if water gets in there, it means there's a leak, but you're not going to dunk that whole thing in water. It's stuck inside. You can't dunk that in water. So it's impossible for two reasons. You don't want to break the kirig, and also you might not get water into that thing anyway, so is that even relevant? These are all discussions to be had. It could be a shear in of itself, the kirig machines, but that's a classic example. Toasters, urns. What else is electronic that people get stuck with? George Foreman. Okay, yeah. Smartphones, right? Everything is. I think in Bnei Brak they have a cold code that says you got to throw your smartphones in a bucket of water in order to break it. That's the point. You got to break it. Okay, so anything digital is going to have this. Anything digital is going to have this issue. He does quote in the next paragraph. Asher Weiss quotes Elishalich Ora Matzina B'Prima Gadim Shecholik Alav. He quotes an interesting case, and it's hard to identify exactly what he's talking about. But the Prima Gadim has a case where he says such sounds similar to what we're talking about, and he's machmir, he's stringent, not like the Chachmas Adam. He said there was a certain type of kli, I don't really understand what it is, but you would buy, it's like a sheet of metal, let's say, and it was basically made, but it needs to be bent into shape or something. It needs to be fixed up in order to make it usable. Imagine it has like a perforation, and you have to break the perforation, something like that, some extra step. And in that case, the Prima Gadim is in doubt. He's mesupak, he's not sure whether that needs to feel as kalim or not. But that sounds like the Chachmas Adam. If you made it in a Jewish property, why should it be a problem? So Rashi Weiss says the Prima Gadim is not an issue for us for two reasons. One is that when you have a suffix of the Prima Gadim, that doesn't decide the halacha against a vadai, someone who is definite, someone who is certain, like the Chachmas Adam. In general, Rav Shechter always points this out. I think it's in the name of the Avnei Nezer, although I can't remember right now. But Rav Shechter always points out that the Prima Gadim in general, anyone who's learned halacha knows that his commentary on Shulchan Aruch is gevaldik. It's enlightening, it shapes the whole sugya for you, but is very often two sides. He gives you two sides, he gives you two possibilities. It might be this or it might be that. He declares a chakira. He makes a lumdis out of the Shulchan Aruch. Now, it's helpful, super helpful. And in many cases, he does give a hachra, he does decide what the halacha should be, but in so many cases, the Prima Gadim just offers a suffix. He offers us, you could really wonder about this question. So the paskin out of the Prima Gadim is very, very difficult. I think the Avnei Nezer used to do this, some part of his smicha b'china to his students, I forget exactly how it went, but he would test them on this and just point out that the Prima Gadim is not a posik in that sense. Obviously, he was a posik himself, the Gavra, but when you use the Sefer, it's not always useful in that exact way. So here too, the Prima Gadim says, maybe I'm not sure. Okay, maybe I'm not sure, but the Chachmas Adam was sure. We trust him. So Rav Asher Weiss says, anyways, that should be okay. Additionally, Rav Asher says that it's not really comparable. If you have like a metal sheet that you just need to bend, you just need to do something to finish the kli, so that's more similar to the following. It means the kli is made to be made by a Jew. When a person buys it from the non-Jew, it's with the intent that you're going to shape it into the kli as it's going to be usable later on. So that's how it's sold. That's how its function is. If you sell me a toaster and I cut off the cord and put it back on, I undid and redid it. But if you sell me something that needs an extra step, that's part of the process, that you just put it together, so then that's not making something new. That's part of the process. Like IKEA gives you the... For me, it's different. For me, whenever I build something IKEA, it comes out panim chadash, as mamish. I built a table, it came out with legs on top. I'm not even exaggerating. My brother-in-law had to come over and drill new holes. I'm the only person with so many holes on an IKEA table. Just a table. It was four legs and... it was three when I was done, but whatever. Anyway, so there was IKEA instructions on how to do it. That's not panim chadash. You just put together what they gave you. Right? You built something that was told to be built that way. It's part of the process. But in our case, you cut off the cord and you redo it, or you drill a hole in the side of the urn and then you fill it up with whatever. You meld it with a heat or something. That will certainly be considered redoing it from scratch. Panim chadash is ba'al lakan. It's a new vessel, and therefore you'd get out of tefilas kelim that way. Yeah. Different halachos, correct? Meaning, first of all, we're talking about a new toaster, but if it would have treif in it, different halachos. Kashering a kli is completely different. You're correct. This kashering kli is completely different than tefillas kelim. They're two different things. You need one without the other, and you need the other without the other one also. Okay, if you look in Oz Beis, the next section over here, Amnam lo echad, dinira lich ora de kli she yefshe lo tov lo bli lashchiso le kalkalo pater min hatfila le gamre umuter le shtamish bo bili tefila. So until now, Rav Asher Weiss told us that he thinks that there's a kunz, there's a trick over here. You can get out of tefillas kelim by undoing and redoing the kli, break it down and remake it. That's one possibility. But it's now Rav Asher Weiss suggests, no, maybe the whole thing isn't a question. It's a moot point in the first place. The question is irrelevant. You're not chayiv. You're not obligated in tefillas kelim when it comes to a kli, which is digital, which is electronic, and will break in the water. You're not chayiv at all. There's nothing to worry about. The ein tefillas kelim geder matir ella geder mitzvah. The idea of tefillas kelim, he talks about this in a previous tshuva, is not, he's making the argument here, this is a discussion, is not that you can't eat off these dishes unless you do tefillas kelim because they're like their treif. Rather, you can't eat off these kelim until you do tefillas kelim because there's a mitzvah of tefillas kelim. But if you can't use the kli after you do tefillas kelim, there's no mitzvah of tefillas kelim in the first place. You keep reading in the bold. Imkei mistaber, it just makes sense. It's just logical. This is important in general in style and psak, but especially in the psakim of Rashi Weiss, as we'll see soon in the Chaznish as well, it's very important to think about what we're saying over here. He's not quoting a source. He's not saying, I have an earlier source that says you're pater in such a case. He's saying it's a svara. It's logical for the following reason. Mistaber de kli amiskalka le de tefillah anasumi letovla. If a person has a kli, a toaster, an urn, a keurig, whatever, and doing tefillas kelim will ruin the kli, it doesn't make sense that you be chayav, that you be obligated in tefillas kelim. Anasumi letovlo. It's impossible to do tefillas kelim on this. The whole idea of tefillas kelim is to be tovel a kli, to dunk the kli in order to use it. So if you're going to dunk the kli and then you can't use it, it doesn't make any sense to have tefillas kelim. The whole mitzvah falls away, falls by the wayside. So, maybe you can't buy it, right? Maybe you can't have such a thing. Good. So Rav Asher Weiss is assuming that it can't be that there are kalim, especially ones that become so regular and so prominent in our lives, that you don't have a fix for. Now, it could be, you have tray food, we'll talk about this a little bit more soon, you have tray food, so there are things that are not allowed in this world. There are things that are not allowed. But the appliances, he assumes, we're able to use our kli suda, our meal food, our mealtime dishes, and if you can't use it because of tefillas kelim, it must be tefillas kelim doesn't apply. So, in the case of the Keurig, you might have that exception, or any other type of electronic appliance. There are others who say, like you, Rav Vosner has a tshuva where he asks this question, tefillas kelim, but the kli is going to break, it's electric, and his answer is basically, too bad, so sad. I'm sorry, either tovel it or don't use it. And if you tovel and you can't use it, then whatever. If you feel like it's a 50-50 chance, take the risk, take the plunge, right? Dunk the appliance in the water and see what happens. Otherwise, you're stuck. It's your own fault, for buying such a kli. I don't know if Schechter always assumed that if the appliances are the type that would be dipped in the water, they would break. He assumed that they're not the chayim and tefillas kelim, and he quotes the Avnei Nezer. The Avnei Nezer Nochayim Simen Taf Yud Ches says that explicitly. Others disagree, but Schechter, the Avnei Nezer, Moshe Heinemann, and obviously Rav Asher Weiss here is bringing it up, assume that it's possible that if something's going to break, there's no issue of tefillas kelim in the first place. It's not a mitzvah in such a case. Now, we're going to see soon, Rav Asher Weiss doesn't rely on this alone, but he definitely suggests this as well. In order to back up his svara and address your point, he says in the next paragraph, v'nira lahavi lezeraya. I can bring a proof for this. He quotes, and this is a really good proof, d'hinei kasav ha-shach. The shach writes in Simon Kuf Chaf in Yerodeya, that's the halachos of tefillas kelim, b'shem Isser v'heter, in the name of the Isser v'heter, an earlier sefer, da'atam sheshutfus goy poteres mitfilas kelim, such an interesting case, says the Shach. The Shulchan Aruch tells us that you have a kli that's owned by a Jew and a non-Jew, so you can sell a partnership in the kli to a non-Jew. You can sell a partnership in the kli to a non-Jew, and that'll work. Why does that work? I have partial ownership, and the guy has partial ownership. So my part is pater. But the guy still owns some of this kli. So the chi of tefillas kelim keeps coming back. So what are you talking about? I didn't pater myself. I'm just half my kli is chayiv, half my kli is not chayiv. Maybe I can only eat on half of the kli. That's what they say from Chaim Soloveitchik. There was a balabas who thought he was such a lamdin. So he would use, he was a poor man. So he had a metal spoon, but he didn't want to have to buy so many kelim. So he didn't want to have the issue of basar b'chalav either. So what he would do is he would use one side for basar and one side for chalav. One side for basar, one side for chalav. So Reb Chaim made fun of him that two halves kosher equals treif. Meaning if you put together two halves and one side is basar, one side is chalav, so then it's treif. The idea being that in order to make something kosher, you need to separate it. You can't your knowledge doesn't help if you combine everything and try using it in such a fancy way. So here too, you're going to have half a kli that's Jewish, half a kli that's Gaiish. It doesn't solve the problem. But apparently, the Shach says, apparently, we should say, fine, so you can never use this kli. It's half Jewish, half Gaiish. You can't use it. The tefillah won't work. No, the answer is, al hanachas hayesod. The fundamental assumption is, dimlo tovela tefillah. If you have a situation in which tefillah won't work because it's half Jewish, half Gaiish, you can't possibly tovel this kli. So you and I might have said, okay, so it's a treif kli. You know what the answer is? No. If you can't tovel the kli, the Shach says, Pitur makolnim milahat bilo. If you can't tovel kli, you're pater, you're exempt. And he wasn't talking about technology, but in our case, it's the same thing. I can't possibly tovel this Keurig machine. I can't possibly tovel this urn, whatever the case might be, an electronic dish. So because of that, I am pater. I'm exempt because tefilas kelim should only apply when you're able to do tefilas kelim. If you're not able to do this tefilas kelim, then you don't have the mitzvah of tefilas kelim in that case. He compares this. This is amazing. He compares this to something from the Chazon Ish. If you look at the next bold section where there's an aleph, a regular aleph, not a central aleph. He says that you have an earlier source for this in the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish is talking about the mitzvah arla. The mitzvah arla is that when you have specifically fruits, not vegetables, in Eretz Yisrael, peros ha'ilan, that in the first 3 years that they are growing, you're not allowed to partake, you're not allowed to get hana from those fruits. Those are called arla. You're not allowed to take hana from the arla. After 3 years, you're allowed to start using the fruit tree. A lot of details. Good. It exists in Eretz Yisrael, and it exists in Chutz La'aretz as well. It has different halachos, but it definitely does exist in Chutz La'aretz as well, but has a few more leniencies. Either way, if you have a fruit like that on a fruit tree, so you can't partake of that fruit for the first 3 years. Now, says the Chazon Ish, what about the following case? Let's say you have a case of a fruit that only produces fruits for 3 years, or for 1 year, or for 2 years, but it doesn't go past that. So if you have a fruit that produces fruit, a tree that produces fruit every year, apples are year to year, right? So every year, or more than that even, I don't know, some of them have just seasons. So every year you're producing apples. So after 3 years, you can't have partaken. No, then after 10 years, you're going to start, you're going to have millions of apples. After 4 years already, you could partake of it, correct? But let's say you have a type of fruit that only produces fruit in the first year, the second year, the third year. Anyone know an example of that? Pineapples. Pineapples are, it's a question scientifically, like botanically, what they're considered. I think that, like bananas, for example, we call fruit, but I think they're actually a berry. I think they're classified as berry or something. So pineapples also, you know, you have these questions, what exactly it's called. But a pineapple grows only for usually like one crop or two crops per year, but only for the first 2 or 3 years. At most, you could push it to 4 years, but usually not even. So is it possible, the Chazon Ish deals with this, is it possible that you have a fruit that exists in the world that's just inedible? Is it possible? So the pineapples are going to grow every year for 2 years. By the third year, it's going to be its last crop. You couldn't partake of it for those years, and then it's going to be dead. It's not going to grow anymore. So you can't eat pineapples. Pineapples are always going to be treif. They're always going to be arla. There's no way out of that. So the truth is, this is a very fascinating machlokes achronim. The Radvaz in Chelek Gimel of his Tshuvas, he assumes yes. He assumes yes, that you can't partake of fruits or fruits like that. So his example is eggplant. Again, I didn't look into this, but apparently eggplant, which he encountered in Eretz Yisrael, seem to be categorized as fruits of a tree and not vegetables. And he claimed, again, I don't know if this is true now or if it was true then, I don't know exactly what the pshat is, but he claimed that the eggplants didn't produce for more than 3 years. Anyone know? Anyone grow eggplant here? Okay.
But it has to be a loophole because eggplant's like the number
one. Okay, yeah, so, yeah, or not, okay. I finally have taught you something. If I told you that eggplants are treif, that would be nice. We finally have learned something together. But so the Radvaz says that they were never permissible. There was never a way to eat eggplant because it just never gets past year three, and you can't have it within the first 3 years. The Tzitz Eliezer has a truth about this as well. However, Rabbi Bleich, who's famous...
But an eggplant's a tree?
That's part of the discussion. The Radvaz assumes it's a fruit tree. The other argument is that it's a vegetable. Correct, right. Correct. But that's part of the discussion, yeah. He was assuming that in that context. Rabbi Bleich quotes from Rav Kook. Rav Kook has a letter where he was asked about a botanical species in existence, which is never going to become mutter. Is that possible? Could you have a fruit that never becomes permissible? So he answered that unlike the animal kingdom, it is impossible. It's impossible that you would ever have any plant or fruit that would become absolutely, you know, eternally forbidden. It can't be. Can't happen. Interesting assumption. Why not? He doesn't really tell you the svara for why not, but he assumes that to be the case. In one of the few cases that the Chazon Ish and Rav Kook saw eye to eye, so the Chazon Ish in Arla writes the same thing. He says it's mistaber. He says, ein svara. It's illogical to say that such a concept could exist, that a fruit could be eternally usser, eternally forbidden. Does anyone have understanding of that halacha? Do you agree with that? Mm-hmm. It makes sense that fruits should always, there should never be a case where fruit is usser. Mm-hmm. Why doesn't it make sense? There are things in the world that are usher forever. So a pig is usher forever. You can't wait a certain amount of years to have pig. It doesn't work like that. A fruit is usually permissible. That's fine. But isn't it possible that some fruits are treif? Isn't it possible? That was before the Torah was given. Once the Torah was given, it qualified. They potentially could have also eaten pig. There were only seven mitzvahs b'nei Noach. Eivor and achai, they couldn't eat, maybe. Maybe a discussion when that exactly came around. But they basically didn't eat any meat anyways. They were not carnivore. What are we called? What are we called?
Carnivores.
We're carnivores? Omnivores, right? Because we do both. Yeah, we do both. Science. A little bit of a scientist on the side. So back then they were herbivores. Herbivores. Yeah, I always get confused between the guy's name and the vegetable thing. Herbie and herbs. Yeah, I always call Herbie Herbie, and then he doesn't respond. Okay, either way, so they didn't really eat the meat or anything like that. That's true, but that was before the Torah was given. The Torah was given, it qualified rules. So we have things that are forbidden. Why did it have to be that it's not forbidden? So I thought at the time when I learned this Chaznish, but I see that's what Rabbi Asher Weiss is saying, black on white over here. He's saying the svar is that no, the svar, the logic over here is based on the fact that the whole concept of Arla, the idea of Arla is that you can't eat fruits within the first 3 years. Meaning, you may eat them in the fourth year. The mitzvah was given in such a way that it's saying, for 3 years, no, but in year four, yes. That's the mitzvah. The mitzvah is that you can't eat them for 3 years, but you can eat them in the fourth year. So some mitzvahs are given that way. The Torah sometimes hinges the iser to eat on the heter that is going to be allowed to be eaten later on. And that's possibly what the Chaznish meant by Arla. That's certainly what Rabbi Asher Weiss assumes over here is what the Chaznish meant. And says Rabbi Asher Weiss, an amazing application. He says the same thing is true by us. The mitzvah of Tilas Kelim, it might be Daraisa, it's a question in the Rishonim, whether it's Daraisa or Darabanan. Even if it's Daraisa, it was given to us that in order to use these Kelim, you need to do Tefilas Kelim. You need to dunk them in water. Which means if dunking them will disallow you from using them, will prevent you from using them because they won't be functional anymore, then the mitzvah can't apply. The mitzvah only applies when they're going to be usable, similar to the case of Arla, and he says he finds, you know, basis for what he's saying in this Chaznish about Arla, which we applied to pineapples a second ago. Very, very fascinating, very, very fascinating idea. If you look in Oz Gimel, when in the middle of the page you have a Gimel, so the Rav Asher Weiss continues, and he says, Nira dekeven she'ena derech lishtos vayim resuchim el lasos bam kafe o te efsher she'en klizet sarach tvila. So he says, it could be, you could argue, that the truth is, this entire kli, I don't know, let's just say a Keurig machine, for example. Keurig is probably not a great example, but an urn, let's say. Keurig might be a good example, it just depends on the model, that's what I'm saying. It's like very hard to say which model, but let's say an urn. An urn is maybe, you can make an argument, it shouldn't be chayiv in Tefilas Kelim in the first place at all. Why? Because, following is a very interesting discussion, the Gemara of Avodah Zarah tells us, that not every kli, not every utensil is chayiv in tefilas kelim. We mentioned before, smartphones are not chayiv in tefilas kelim. Why not? They're kli, they're utensils, they are functional things that we use. So why shouldn't be chayiv in tefilas kelim? Good. So the Gemara asks about a case of zuza de sarbala, which is basically like scissors that you use to cut wool. Does that need tefilas kelim? The Gemara answers no, it doesn't need tefilas kelim. Why? Because the psukim in Parshas Matos are clearly referring to clay suda, kelim, which are tzarchei suda, which are needed for a meal. That's what is chayiv in tefilas kelim. What is considered needed for a meal? So forks and knives and spoons, that's for sure true. That's for sure needed for a meal. But then there are these gray areas. A coffee machine, is that a meal utensil? It prepares food. It's preparatory. What about a peeler? You know, you peel the cucumbers, you peel the whatever you peel. With a peeler, all those things are preparatory, but are they a meal kli? Are they a meal utensil or they're not a meal utensil? That's where you get into a lot of gray areas. You have to ask, each case is a little bit different. That's what I mentioned before. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva in Yerodei Achela Gimel where he discusses toasters. And he has a big chiddush that he thinks toasters do not need tefilas kelim. Toasters don't need it at all. And he argues that that's because the bread is perfectly edible before it's toasted. When you toast it, you just make it, whatever, you make it look nice, you make it taste a little crunchier, but it's perfectly edible before it was toasted. So the toaster isn't a kli suda. It's not changing the food in any real way.
But a dish doesn't.
Neither does a fork, right? Yeah, so it's a big chiddush to say such a thing. It's a very difficult tshuva. Most of the poskim do not agree with it. It's not the accepted opinion. Yeah. Coffee maker, most of the poskim do assume it's very much a kli suda, and that's because it literally renders the food edible. It makes it possible to eat. However, Rav Asher Weiss just adds over here that in the case, let's say, of the Keurig case that I said before, so you have a big Keurig machine. Inside there's a heating tank. So the water sits in the heating tank. It gets heated up by the tank, and it sits in there for maintaining its heat. Fine. That water is drinkable, correct? It's hot water. That's fine. But, and don't raise your hand if you're an exception, but most people don't just drink plain hot water. Don't raise your hand if you're an exception. We're not going to be able to look at you the same afterwards. Most people don't just drink plain hot water. most people take plain hot water and pour it through coffee grounds or pour it into tea. Or, I don't know, at the very least, they put a lemon in there or something, right? People usually don't just drink plain hot water. So because of that, even though it's true, this is a fascinating, this is a chiddush, and the Rav Ashi says it's a chiddush, he says, it's a svara klusha, which means it's a weak. He says, you know, I know I'm saying a weak svara over here, but he says it's possible that if you have something that just heats up water, it's not really a kli suda either. Does it heat the water? Yes. The water was drinkable before and it was drinkable after, like we said from about the toasters from Moshe Feinstein. Additionally, that's not the type of thing that you drink. You don't drink that. You need to then use it to go through the coffee grounds. The pin will be a different question. The pin is going through the coffee grounds, but the tank itself or an urn on its own maybe wouldn't be an issue. Rav Ashi says, this is not a good answer. You can't use this across the board, but I already told you that you could break the kli and redo it. I already told you that you could potentially, you know, sell part of it to a guy. I already told you that it's maybe not chayv in the first place because it's electronic and maybe the whole thing isn't chayv, like we said from the Chaznish, etc. So many reasons over here. If you add up all the reasons, then you'll end up with a kula as well. When I learned the sugya about tefillas kelim, again, I told you it was maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago. So I worked on Keurigs in particular, and I gave a shiur on it. I know I gave a shiur on it for the following reason. So I mentioned 5 tzadim lahakel. I felt there were 5 reasons that you can be makel. I mean, again, like we just said, like, you know, the fact that it's just a heating element, the fact that it's all the way buried inside might be a reason to be makel as well. The fact that it's plugged into a wall is an interesting discussion. If something's plugged into a wall, it might lose its status as a utensil. It's very interesting. And the fact that it's electronic and will break, for all those reasons, maybe it's a not chayv and tefillas kelim. So I set a shiur on this, and fine. So a year or two later, I was trying not to give away details, so I was somewhere, and a Rav and I were talking about halachas of something or other, and he asked me what I thought about Keurigs. It was like a year or two after this year. So I said, Keurig machines, I thought there were 5 tzadim lahakel. I'm not a posik, but I thought there were 5 tzadim lahakel, and I laid out the 5 things for him. He said, you know, I had the exact same thought. So I said, I said, oh, very good. Okay, so I was mechavim. He was a real rabbi. He was a posik. I said, oh, it's mechavim. He said, no, but I got it from somewhere. I mean, like, I had this thought, but like, and I gave a shiur on it, but like, I know it from somewhere. So I was like, oh, I mean, like, there's this makor, there's that makor, there's this makor. He's like, no, the way you said it, like, I know it that way. So I was like, okay, I don't know. So he's like, no, I'm telling you, I heard a shiur. Did you hear it from a rabbi at YU? So I said, no, I mean, parts yes, parts no, but not particularly. He's like, let me look at my notes. So he goes to his notes, and he finds a link to the shiur that he had listened to. And it was my shiur. It was my shiur. He listened to my shiur. He was ripping off my shiur in front of my face. Unbelievable. The truth is, it wasn't offensive. It was flattering. You know, a young person without a beard. I didn't have a beard then. He was a real rub. He was listening to the shiur, and he was willing to admit it, which was very, very kind of him. So that was what I thought back then. It was 5 possible reasons. So that's what Rav Ashi Weiss is doing over here too. He's adding on reason after reason. Not that any independent reason is good enough on its own, but if you put them all together, you certainly have enough room, enough legs to stand on. More legs than my IKEA table from before. Oz Dalid in the middle over here at the end. So Rav Ashi Weiss here explains that, of course, you have the classic case that you're allowed venir od bezed di yesh lahakel al yedei haknas hakli lagai. So certainly you can cut off the cord and redo it or make a hole and refashion it. That's fine. The other thing which a lot of people are familiar with is you could be makne. You could sell the kli to a non-Jew, and then it's not your kli anymore and you're just borrowing, and that would be okay. L'chor nira the adif tfei lahakel sunachri rak chelik b'kli la'asos ha-shutaf. Better, like the Shach said before, to make it a half-Jewish kli, to only convert it halfway, and then you'll have the etza to get out of tefillas kelim in general. Even though Rav Ashi Weiss here addresses, we don't have time to get into this. This would be a whole shiur in its own right. In fact, it's a whole book in its own right. I'll give a plug for it soon. Not my book. But Rav Ashi Weiss says, this sounds like a harama. A harama, do you know what that is, that word? A trick. So there's many ways to interpret the word harama. None of them are perfectly accurate. And that's actually the subject of the book that I'm about to mention to you. But I used to always translate harama as subterfuge, which I realized later in life confuses people more than it helps. So the only other English word I know for harama is kunz. Huh? Ha'arama, with an ayin. Ha'arama. Yeah, that's how the Sephardim would say it. A kunz, a trick, evasion, alternative, you know, I don't know, you can find a million different words for it. None of them are perfect, because if ha'arama is mutter, if we assume that these forms of, so to speak, trickery or evasion are permissible, a kind of loophole is a bad word to use for ha'arama, because it sheds a bad light on what the person is doing and what the Torah implied. Meaning, loophole implies when you have a tax law, so if you find a loophole in a tax law, it means the tax people are only so smart, and we are a little smarter, for sure, us, you know, for sure the Jewish chevra, we're a little smarter. We found a loophole. It's totally legal, because they didn't think of it. You find a loophole in the Aseret HaDibros, what do they call them? The Constitution, right? You find a loophole in the Constitution. So what's the pshat? It's that the guys with the wigs weren't as smart as they thought they were. We found a loophole. We found a way around it. So you wouldn't want to say that about the Torah. You wouldn't even want to say that about Derabanans, about the rabbis. They didn't miss anything. It's not a loophole. It's somehow built into the system that there are cases in which there's, again, bad word, workarounds, that you can find a way to do what you need to do and avoid the issue. There's an evasion of the issue. So we have Talmud Chacham with us in L.A. right now. He's actually in San Diego currently, but he's with us for Shabbos. Rabbi Daniel Feldman. He's a Rosh Yeshiva at YU. He's a brilliant, brilliant Talmud Chacham. I would encourage everyone to look up his shiurim online. Very, very fascinating individual and just an incredible, he's a great speaker as well. So he's also a prolific author. He's written a lot of works. He's edited a lot of works. He's in charge of the Reitz Press, which is the YU publishing house. So he writes a lot of nice English books, very high English and amazing sources. So he has going to print in January, I think, like meaning at the end of this month, he has going to print a book called Letter and Spirit. It's not in print yet, but I have a few snapshots on my phone. He texted me this morning a few pictures of it where he discusses this issue, the whole introduction to his book, which again is coming out January 20th. No one wrote down the date for some reason. Letter and Spirit. You guys are just going to remember that? How are you going to buy this and tell him, and use the code Steinmetz to get a discount? So Rabbi Feldman is publishing this book. So there he spends the whole introduction to the book trying to explain how hard it is to come up with the right word to translate Ha'arama, because it's not a loophole, it's not a workaround, it's not an evasion, it's not a trick, it's not a subterfuge, it's not a kunz, it's something else. That's the Ksava Kabbalah writes something like that in Chumash, Mirma. But even the word Mirma is a discussion in the Rishonim there. Unklus and Rashi say it doesn't mean deceit. It means Chachma, it means smartness. Right. Correct. But they might be... Correct. Cleverness, correct. I'm sorry?
It's a hack. We had to wait...
A hack. Okay, another... There you go.
That word came.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So anyways, he spends a whole bunch of pages trying to find the right word. And basically what he comes out with is something very interesting. He says it can't be that you're beating the system. That can't be what a haram is. He says rather, and this will leave hanging a little bit, there's a letter of the law and there's a spirit of the law. When it comes to daraisas, Rav Asher Weiss says that some people assume that haramas are not permissible by daraisas, but are, yeah, permissible by derabanans. What would that distinction be based on? So when it comes to the Torah, there's a letter of the law and the spirit of the law. You can't get around the Torah. The Torah says something, and then there's a spirit of the law that you can never get around. When the rabbis came and made gezeras, not that there were loopholes, but they made gezeras and they said, this is aser, everything else is mutter. They intended these haramos. They intended that the letter of the law was strictly the letter of the law, and the spirit of the law was left to be determined whether they included that or whether there were ways around that, that there were evasions of quote-unquote the spirit of the law by abiding only by the letter of the law. So that's maybe a distinction between daraisas and darabanan, and may give you a little bit of an insight. Again, you have to read the book to really understand how this applies and when it applies. Do you guys remember what the name of the book is? Letter and Spirit. Wow, very good. You guys are good. So, Rabbi Daniel Feldman. No, he's Jewish, and it didn't come out yet. So that was one possibility in terms of that. So Rav Asher Weiss ends by the tshuva by saying mikol makom nira. He says that the ideal is to take all the approaches, be machmir, be stringent, and either sell the kli partially to a non-Jew or break it down and redo it in the hands of a Jew, and this way you avoid the issue entirely. Is it possible to put together tzadim that the whole thing is exempt in the first place? Yes, it's possible. But certainly you could rely on these kulas, which are a little bit chumras, meaning to break it down and remake it, or to give it to a non-Jew. You can certainly rely on that, given all of the kulas that may exempt it all in all completely. So as I said before, Schechter and others were more makel on that. They assume that it's just totally pater. But if you, mios tov, al tikri ra, whatever the pasuk says, better to do it the best way possible. So if you want to be on the up and up, you'll go ahead and sell it, or you'll go ahead and break it and redo it, and that will get you out of the issue of tefilas kelim on electronic items. Okay, we'll stop here. I